All right. We'll call the meeting to order. The we've got the. I don't think we've got quite a quorum yet, do we, guys?
I think we're good. Close enough.
Golly, from the two past chairs of the committee, who never really counting was never really their forte, but
we didn't do finance, Mr. Chairman.
We're close. So what we'll do is we've got a couple items, and thank you to Representative Hoppe. I asked Mr. Barrett to give us a brief update on the latest electronic poll tab numbers because the January numbers just came out. Representative Hoppe was gracious enough last night to say that that would be fine by the minority. We're not going to take any action. We're just looking for a brief update, and then we will listen to the PUC and the Explore Minnesota Tourism folks about their operations and budgets. But Mr. Barrett, can you give us a sense of what the latest and greatest numbers show in January relative to electronic poll tabs?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Tom Barrett, Director of the Gambling Control Board. And as I promised last committee meeting, absolutely come back, provide an update. We've closed the books on January for charitable gaming. I know the primary focus is on the electronic side, but again, charitable gaming overall is showing an uptick in activity, which benefits obviously the state, but more importantly, the charities. As relates to the electronic activity, we're showing a total of $1.7 million that was wagered during the month of January with an 85% prize payout that equates about a $264,000 net to the charities that are currently conducting electronic gaming. That's right now at 140 sites. Year-to-date, since we started offering electronic games for sale, it's nearly $6 million in gross sales or approximately $900,000 in net receipts to the charities. We have two manufacturers that are currently providing the products, the games. One additional vendor has been approved, but their games are pending final testing. We have three manufacturers that are in for license application consideration, going through the background checks. But while they're going through that, we're also meeting with those vendors to be up to speed on the products that they're preparing, if approved for licensing. We have nine distributors that are approved to deliver, handle the electronic games. And then we have two linked bingo vendors since we met last time the board has approved an additional vendor. Some sites are doing very well. Obviously, we know a lot of the media and picked up on the overall totals, but hopefully in front of you is what I would call the top 10 list of sites. Do you have this? Okay. And what's interesting from this list, this report, is how they're spread around the state. There's no metro area focus. And frankly, all 10 of these sites are relatively small bars. They're not the big bar sites that we equate with the number of devices. But those are some of the indicators as far as locations, such as Harry's Bar in Hill City, number one site right now, with gross receipts last month of $88,000, or ultimately a net receipts of $13,000 for the charity. Those numbers equate to revenue estimates that are above the projections that we were looking at when this bill first came to be. So I guess the point I want to make is we are seeing some sites that are doing quite well as relates to electronics and the sale of paper. We had projected a decrease in paper activity when the electronics came out. And right now for the 140 sites, that is not materialized. In fact, Porky's Bar in St. Paul had an increase, significant increase, not only electronics, but in paper sales. So while on behalf of the board, I'd like to say I wish we were further ahead in terms of sites. We've worked with representatives from the charities. We've worked with representatives of the bar industry to help educate. But it is a factor that should we be further along, or were we expecting to be further along in sites? Yes. Will we get there? We certainly hope so and anticipate. But it's just a matter of how much time.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Are there questions for Mr. Barrett? I have... And Ms. Barrett, in the handouts, I don't know if you saw.
I just got it.
We did some math, the per site anticipated net for our projections was about $208 per day. the per site average that we're seeing in January is about $76 per day. We're just one, and you've got some great examples of some sites that are doing phenomenally well. And it'd be interesting to, and not necessarily at this hearing per se, but obviously if these sites are doing this well, and the average net is only 76 overall, that there must be some sites that are just getting pounded and making no money at all. And the hope would be that we'd be able to figure out, because we're only at about one-third of what the average net per site per day is supposed to be at this point. And even if we get the 2,500 sites by July, that the revenue, the newly revised lower revenue note is based on, if it keeps coming in at this kind of rate, we've still got a problem even if we get the number of sites. Is there... here's where the question is. Is there something that gets all of the sites into this category? I mean, is there something that we're missing that that will boost those revenues from the various sites, or are we just locked in at $76 per site?
Mr. Chair, and again, come from the regulator's perspective, a different model in terms of is the board's goal to... mission to market. Our mission is obviously to maintain the integrity and make sure the charities get the money to the charitable cause. But at the same time, knowing the importance of this thing, we've worked pretty close with the manufacturers coming on board. I think this example at the top 10, working with reps from the industry, working with reps from the bars to go, why does it work so well here? And it's not just one or a couple sites, but I brought some examples for, again, Porky's Bar, but this is a site that was involved pretty much the close at startup. When you look at some of the activity pre-electronics and then post-electronics, their sales are up in both categories. So to take that and say, industry, here's some models, Jason and I can't remember the other gentleman's name at Porky's, why does it work there? I know the distributors are anxious to get this information out. There's some friendly competition, but there's some unhealthy competition when you look at comparisons in the different types of games. But that's where competition, I think, is good.
And Representative Anseltz, and congratulations to Representative Swedzinski on being so quick-handed. He caught his Dr. Pepper just as it was about to spill. But Representative Anseltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barrett, you know how much I appreciate the work you do, and you know that I understand the balance between your role as a regulator and your role as a promoter or marketer of the business, and I know it's difficult. However, now that we've had some experience here, might there be another business model? Might there be another mechanism? Might there be another way to frame the relationship between the Gambling Control Board, the manufacturers, the distributors, the charities, and the sites in order to facilitate, promote more aggressively so that the goals outlined in that complicated piece of legislation are potentially more attainable, rather than the model that we're seemingly stuck with. I'm concerned that it appears as though we're stuck. We've got a problem, and we got to get unstuck, and we're going to have to be creative. Would you care to comment?
Mr.
Chairman, could you repeat the question?
Mr. Barrett, if you could repeat the question back for us. We recognize, by the way, that you are the regulator, not the producer of these things, so we get that. But you're obviously a keen observer of what's going on in the market. Can you address what Representative Anseltz has raised?
Hey, Mr. Chair and Representative Anseltz, I'll do my best, and to all the members. Because sitting in our regulatory role, we do have an opportunity to be very open, what's going on, politically neutral. We also understand the importance, but knowing there's limitation, and it's not just staffing or the like, but the model you talk about, the model, because when we were heading into this legislation, we looked at the model that's existing for charitable gambling, which, again, number one in the country for activity. Do we maintain that model? And there was much discussion, but this is where we talked with reps from the industry, open market. If you're qualified as a vendor to produce the product, you're qualified as a distributor to deliver the product, and obviously registered charity. But that was one of the opportunities we said, should we do something different? And while there was some hesitation and protection of, you know, the paper vendors, they don't want to lose market, or the distributors and the distributor loyalty. But that's where we see some of the impact on, not to blame that model, we see some of the distributors that have been loyal to the charities and locations providing the product. Not all of them have access to an electronic vendor yet. And so, wait, you know, we're going to get there when we maybe have more vendors. And I think that's some of the things, while it's maybe critical of where we're at today, does the model work? Pretty good when you look at that three-tier manufacturer separation, the distributor, and the charity to deliver the product. Everybody keep everybody else honest for the games. So I'm not so much sure we would change the model to the extent that we act as more of a promoter, stopping short of that. But as I mentioned, ahead of even their licensing, we've worked with the vendors on their product development. So when they are ready to go, if they're ready to go, it's out to the market as quick as can be. So confident for what I thought we put in place. Hindsight, there's some quirks. We know there's some locations that would prefer to have the electronics and not paper. But the law requires paper. But that's one of those things that, you know, it'll settle. Again, we show examples where paper sales are maintaining or providing or increasing. That's good to hear for the paper vendors. But model, we're going to try our best to do what we can. We're going to come back to keep everybody apprised of what's the latest. Are there other options out there? There were other options last year discussed, but I think the industry is looking for just, yeah, as the board is, give us some time. I know we've heard that before, but you know, can they develop other models, other options? We'll certainly stand ready to respond.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Representative Anseltz, anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Church, and thank you for the response. Very basic question. How much time do we have?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anseltz, in relation to bond payment? Because that's what I think, and I won't get caught up in the...
Yes.
The issues of the bonds. I know, again, from our rollout projections, we had hoped to be at least 300 sites by now. We're at 140. So meeting tomorrow with revenue to go over our projections where we think we are going to be. They're going to put that in the revenue forecast, but I don't have the technical background on the when the first bond payment is due.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Barrett? And for committee members, this is now the second time Mr. Barrett has had an opportunity to join us. I know that he loves every moment with our committee. If there's anybody that hasn't been following the trail of breadcrumbs that I've been leaving, I am deeply concerned about where the revenues are at. We're only at about a third of the revenue per site that was projected to be generated. Mr. Mossman from Revenue the other day told us the newly revised lower revenue note was based on 2,500 sites up and running by July 1st. Mr. Barrett, we're at 140 sites right now. The gross per device was anticipated to be $225 per device. I believe that we were somewhere in the neighborhood of, and I had it on my little device here, is in the neighborhood of about about $200 per device on a gross. The final item, I believe, was the $208 net per day was at 79 for the first vendor. The second vendor that rolled out this month with the hope that it was going to be a terrific outcome, their net is only about $17 a day. So it's just a little, and fortunately, Mr. Barrett, I appreciate your bringing along this sheet to show that there are, in fact, some success stories. I think it's important for us to try to figure out what it is that is making this successful in some places and try to make sure that information gets out to others. Ms. Barrett.
Thank you. One more comment, because I know we equate or dial it down to the gross and net per device. And that was part of the focus of the original estimate. But as you can see on that spreadsheet where the simple column that says PT, that relates to the pull tab devices. And for all these small locations, the maximum devices are 6. And with the exception of 2, none of the other sites are even at the maximum usage placement of the devices. So as we come back to your committee with updates, our main focus are going to be what's the average per site. Because you could certainly load up a site with 6 devices and affect that per device number. So we're going to come back with numbers that are more keyed towards what's happening at each site almost regardless of the number of devices.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Actually, the figure that I was referencing is in this that's been passed out. We started with gross sales per device that was in the neighborhood of $400 or $500 per device. Granted, that was when they were brand new, and they had sort of an excitement factor. But now it's a little bit right around $100 per device. I like the way you're doing it, though, with per site rather than per device. I think that's more accurate. And Mr. Lund from Allied Charities, I talked to him earlier today and asked him to provide some sense of where things are at. So in your packets, you'll find a couple paragraphs I'll let Mr. Lund speak for himself in the where things are at relative to Allied Charities. But with the fact that where we're at right now, I think it's important for this committee, which is charged with gaming issues, to start thinking about what possibilities might be out there if there's going to be some need to make a change. Because when you're talking about a stream of revenue that was supposed to be grossing $100 million a month and it's grossing $1.7 million and we're 5 months in, we got to make sure that we've got the options available to us in terms of what we may or may not have to do. Mr. Barrett, thank you for returning to us again on short notice. We just talked yesterday, and I expect we'll continue to have conversations and get updates from you.
Mr. Chair, I appreciate it in the committee and happy to come back again. It's a hot topic.
Thank you very much. And first on our agenda after that update from Mr. Barrett is the approval of the minutes. We now have a quorum. Representative Halverson moves the minutes of the last meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
That was from February 5th. Anyone opposed to the minutes of the February 5th meeting? Seeing none, all in just oppose that. The motion carries. Next up is the overview of the governor's budget proposal and operations relative to the Public Utilities Commission. And I believe we have Ms. Battles-Jenks. Ms. Battles-Jenks, welcome to the committee. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, I'm Marcia Battles-Jenks. I'm the Administrative Management Director for the Public Utilities Commission, which basically means the CFO, HR, Human Resources, Purchasing, and Accounting. So there are other issues. I'll do my best. I thought we'd start out with a little bit about what the Public Utilities Commission does. And we are a quasi-judicial agency that regulates three sort of cornerstone industries in Minnesota, major retail service industries, including the electricity, regulation of electricity, natural gas rates, and local telephone companies. And I have in our handouts here on page 2 sort of a listing of who our principal customers are at this time. And as you can see, it's quite a number of entities, some larger than others. But I wanted to just give you a little flavor for our customer base and who it is that we regulate. And for those of you who don't know the telephone acronyms, the 205 competitive local exchange companies, and then the 400 inter-exchange companies, it's for intrastate long distance. So we have a lot of varied issues.
And Ms. Battles-Jenks, for your planning purposes, I know there's a handful of members that have guests coming, I believe, for this evening's State of the State address by the governor. So we've got probably about 15 minutes for you to do your overview, 5 minutes worth of questions, and then we've got our friends from the Tourism Explore Minnesota.
Okay.
Just for...
I will move ahead. And as you can see, the next slide is the impact on the state economy. We're looking at a $7 billion industry in Minnesota, and that's just the jurisdiction of the folks that we regulate. Statutory mission, to ensure safe, adequate, and reliable services at fair and reasonable rates. And as of 2005, we also received legislative authority to approve sites and routes of large energy facilities. This would be power plants, wind generators, other kinds of large energy-producing facilities. And that is one that was a task added in 2005. And then also to foster effective competition for Minnesota telephone companies. The governor's budget recommendation for the commission for the biennium 2014-15 is $12.356 million, a little over $6 million a year, and special revenue funds, which include revenues for the telephone assistance program and revenues for the recovery for the administrative law judge. The Public Utilities Commission budget on the next slide sort of gives you the breakup in a pie chart, but the major thing to take away from this is that the Public Utilities Commission recovers its costs through utility assessments. And virtually all of the costs that we incur are recovered and deposited into the general fund as non-dedicated receipts. So we reimburse the general fund for what we spend. Budget is recovered. The priorities for budget use, decision-making process based on a formal record of evidence. This is extremely important to us. We're quasi-judicial, and we want to make sure that we have a formal record that can be supported in the appeal process and in the court system. Active engagement with all stakeholders. We certainly want to do that because it is part of developing a complete record upon which to make balanced and reasonable decisions. Public outreach to support orderly and informed decision making, and that's going to be critical because sometimes people don't understand how to participate in the process. We're making an effort to have them do that. Extensive use of technology. We are working now on redesigning our website and also working on a new agenda management tool to allow better interactive access to the public on some of our documents. And active engagement in regional and national forums. I think the most pressing budget issues that we have are developing staff for the long term. You'll see that the Public Utilities Commission carried forward quite a bit of funds from fiscal 2012 to 2013. And the story there is we had a large amount of staff turnover. Lost 14 positions in the first 18 months of this biennium. So we are almost at full staff now, but obviously continuing to attract and retain staff is going to be an issue for the commission. And we're exploring strategies on how to do that. We've had, of course, a number of retirements. About 20% of our staff is near retirement age. And in addition, we had quite a few people leave for greener pastures. So just wanted to let the committee know, you see that there's a lot of roll forward there, a lot of carry forward. That is salary savings exclusively from 14 positions. I think the other thing that we're going to continue to do and invest in is our electronic technology. As you know, we do have a lot of, we try to have filings done electronically. This has saved us tremendous amounts of resources, and we've done good work with our website and our audio streaming capability to allow the public to participate in commission meetings. But we're working to improve those areas. As our regulatory operations, you know, what do you get for your $6 million? Well, a year. We have about 1,800 to 2,000 utility filings annually. And over 4,000 consumer complaint cases are mediated by our staff with the utilities. And we also participate in regional power supply planning through the Midwest Independent System Operator, which is a group that does regional power supply planning and distribution for our area. That is requiring more time from us. I always like to put in a little bit of comparison about how we are in comparison to other states. I have a slide here on comparative staff size, and you can see we took states with similar populations and similar utility profiles and compared them against Minnesota PUC. We have 54 positions authorized. And if we combine that with the folks at Commerce, who also participate in the process, we are still under the average, which for most states is 134 positions for their Public Utilities Commission. So we just want to let you know that we're among the lowest staffed groups in the country, but we think that technology has allowed us to carry out our functions without having a lot of people. And then comparisons with other states in other areas. Minnesota ranks 44th out of 50 for residential gas rates and 32nd in the country for electricity rates. That's from highest to lowest. Conservation and renewable energy. Minnesota is in the top 5 states for renewable energy generation and in the top 10 for energy conservation. Minnesota ranks among the top 10 most competitive states in the telephone market, which is going some. And Minnesota ranks first in accessibility to telephone service for its residents. And that was put out by the FCC. That's FCC data, Federal Communications Commission. And then Minnesota ranks in the lowest 20% in staff size per capita. I hope that covers it. Same level budget is pretty standard, but I just wanted to give you a few other things to think about. Well, so
I appreciate the presentation, Ms. Battle-Jenks. Are there questions or concerns for, yes, Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me, how does Minnesota compare on energy rates for our businesses?
Ms. Battle-Jenks?
I'm going to get some help here from...
You mean with all of those hats that you wear?
Administrative.
If you could just identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Janet Gonzalez. I'm the manager of the Energy Unit at the Public Utilities Commission. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, you know, I don't have those figures with me. It kind of depends. Business gets divided between commercial, industrial, and depending on sizes. I know we're in the lower third of rates. But, you know, business rates are much harder to compare because there's demand and there's size. I know we're generally, we've for the last 10, 15 years been in the lower third. I could get some better data on that, but we're somewhere in that range.
Thank you, Ms. Gonzalez. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Gonzalez, if you could also include a comparison to Minnesota and the 5 area states, I think that would be helpful, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, we can do that. I know that there's some data that's published by the Energy Information Administration regionally, breaks it down in regions.
Thank you, Ms. Gonzalez. Are there other questions for either Ms. Gonzalez or Ms. Battles-Jenks? Okay. Well, thank you very much. This is kind of a jumping off point for this new role for this committee in terms of the finance piece. There is, at least my experience in other committees, has been that if it's not general fund, it doesn't undergo the same sort of scrutiny as a general fund expenditure. I think you'll find differently in this committee. I did have one question that's come up in a variety of places, and that is relative to interim rates. And the point of that question is that some of the utilities argue for the interim rates because it takes a long time to get through the process. I've heard estimates of 16, 17 months to get a decision. Would it help to have higher rates, more staff, and therefore the ability to make the decision sooner, or is it just a situation that it's always going to take quite a while to get through the decision-making process? And I looked. It looks like Ms. Battles-Jenks is looking at Ms. Gonzalez. And if there's an answer that would better come from someone else, that's just fine too. We're not. This isn't the be-all end-all necessarily here today. Ms. Gonzalez?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a tough question. I mean, there is a certain amount of time that's needed just to get through the process. I mean, from the time a case is filed to the time the final order is issued is generally 10 months. However, once you have the what's so-called final order issued, there's the ability under the law for reconsideration, which, you know, would add another 2 months or so to the process. You have, and almost invariably we get requests from someone for reconsideration. You also have actually calculating the rates that will implement the commission's decision. It's a compliance filing. It needs to be reviewed. So there are a number of steps at the end. So the 16, 17 months would include that whole process. The actual evidentiary process is more like a 10-month process. I think it would be very difficult for most cases to consolidate that any more than it is right now. There needs to be time for investigation. The Department of Commerce and other interveners need to look at the information. It does depend somewhat on the utility and how recently they filed a rate case, how up-to-date the information is. But I think it would be very, I mean, just my personal opinion, I guess, would be very difficult to shorten the actual hearing investigation part of the process. Perhaps there could be some economies on the other end, but there also, remember, this is most of the decisions in a rate case are quasi-judicial and have to withstand court scrutiny, and we do get appealed to court sometimes, and you really do need a good evidentiary record. It would be hard to develop in much less time.
Thank you, Ms. Gonzalez. Thank you, Ms. Battles-Jenks. Unless there's any other questions from other members, thank you very much and have a good day. We'll look forward to continuing the conversation in the future. Next up is Explore Minnesota Tourism. Thank you for joining us. I think you folks were sitting with us when I noted earlier we've got some members of the committee, I think, who are looking to be out by about 5 o'clock as they have guests coming for the State of the State. So hopefully in about 20-plus minutes or so, Mr. Edmund, you can kind of walk us through the operations a little bit in terms of what the governor's budget is proposing relative to the Explore Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Technology willing, we'll be able to get you out of here in 20 minutes or less. Just pardon a moment.
Oh, you got it.
Is that on?
It's always harder when you've got 40 people that are looking at you as you try to use technology, too, I think. But no problem at all.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your patience, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Edmund, and I am Director of Explore Minnesota. Appreciate this opportunity to give you a brief overview of our agency. What I'm going to do here in the time allotted is just talk briefly about tourism in general in Minnesota, talk about our goals, a little bit of background for those of you who aren't familiar with our agency, talk about some of the customers that we serve, and then discuss the governor's the current budget, and then comparing it to the recommendations from the governor, and then hopefully allow time for Q&A. To kind of start this off, this is really short, I promise, Mr. Chair and members. I have a brief 3-minute video that kind of gives the foundation for why tourism impacts communities all throughout the state. So with your permission, I'd just like to show that.
Well, we wouldn't expect anything different. We expect a video from you guys. So.
Right. Well, thank you.
And our standards are high when we're talking about you folks. We figure it'll be a good video, too.
People do want to come to Minnesota. It's a great state. It's got hills. It's got flatlands. It's got rivers. It's got the Great North Shore. So why wouldn't you want to come to Minnesota?
And I think that's the beauty of tourism, its ability to rejuvenate, revitalize main streets.
20%, one out of every 5 people that come to the Walker are tourists.
There's something about Lake Superior that just draws people.
We do a tremendous number of weddings. We've had weddings from outstate.
Our population doubles. If it's in Brainerd, Detroit Lakes, Alexandria, Otter Tail, our population doubles within the area for tourism.
Not only do we get visitors from just the upper Midwest and our surrounding states, but I get visitors from all over the world.
With the opening of the global market, there was no question that, Lake Street had a tourist attraction.
So they come to Minnesota, they come to the Midtown Global Market to continue that tourism experience that they have in other countries, experience the world in one location.
Without the small businesses, we wouldn't exist, and without tourism, they wouldn't exist.
We know that our hotels and restaurants are critical partners in the relationship with the Walker.
We employ small businesses like electricians, contractors, plumbers.
Whether that's florists or cake decorators or transportation companies.
At the global market, we employ over 200 people.
Tourism has a definite effect on employment at the company. Tourism is a big driver for jobs.
They're spending two, three, four nights in a hotel, many restaurants, shopping, going down to the Mall of America, taking our public transit, of course, traveling through the airport perhaps, or renting a car. All of those things matter a lot to the whole economic engine.
Are there opportunities to increase tourism? I would say definitely yes.
All too often, we're a hidden treasure.
If I can impart any advice for people in tourism, it's to, focus on that authentic experience.
We need to let more people know what we have here.
And I think there's more opportunity to look at those off months, those winter months, and those holiday times to get people up here.
There's a huge market out there around the country, and I can't hit that market by myself.
We find that they may have come into the state knowing one or two things about Minnesota, but they leave very pleasantly surprised.
I guarantee you that when they come back.
It's a snowballing kind of effect.
I think the more people that we can expose to Minnesota, the better.
So there's hundreds of stories outside of the Twin Cities, and there's 101 stories inside the Twin Cities of things going on that make it a really wonderful place to visit.
We have a city, easy to get to, hard to leave.
So if there was a way we could get that message out to more people, think what that would do for everyone.
So, Mr. Chair, members, I think that helps explain better than I can about what tourism means to communities all throughout the state of Minnesota. It's not just those tourism-related businesses. It's all those other businesses upon which our economy depends. Because tourism in Minnesota brings in spending, supports quality of life, and it also helps sell the state not only for travel but also a place to work and do business. Our goals are kind of carved up in four different areas. One is to increase the number of resident travelers in Minnesota. We have about 71 million people that come to the state every year. That's over 13 times the population of the state. We also try to grow tourism receipts. Tourism in Minnesota is nearly a $12 billion industry. It's supporting a tremendous amount of sales tax. 41% it grew between the year 2003 and 2011. State and local taxes, $769 million is generated each year from state and local taxes from leisure and hospitality, and that represents 17% of all sales tax in Minnesota. And of course, to focus on jobs, the leisure and hospitality jobs in Minnesota is about 240,000 with a payroll of $4 billion, and that represents, as I said, 11% of the total private sector employment. Now, if you're not familiar with Explore Minnesota Tourism, we're a non-cabinet level agency. We're relatively a small organization. We have about 60 full and part-time individuals, or 60 full-time part-time people, 46 FTEs with offices in Brainerd, Duluth, Thief River Falls, Mankato, and St. Paul. And we also operate six state staff travel information centers. Three basic units, marketing and PR, that's where you see all the advertising, the international, the media relations come out of. The operations and technology, which is a critical component of what we do to connect with consumers, both through our website as well as through our mobile sites and other digital means. And it also houses our distribution and contact center. And then our industry relations unit is the unit that has the offices throughout the state. We have a small grant program. We manage the travel information centers, and we also engage in some meetings and conventions and sports marketing programs. One of the other things that's relatively unique about us is we're guided by a tourism council. It's a 28-person Tourism Council, it's an advisory board made up of different parts of our industry, whether it's chambers, resorts, retail, et cetera. There's also four legislators, two from the House, two from the Senate, that serve on that council. The customers that we serve, this I won't go through all these numbers. You could read them at your leisure, but you'll see that primarily the growth has been in the website and electronic. That's where people are coming to us at Explore Minnesota. And it's not just coming to our site. It's also linking through to other businesses in destinations throughout the site. Also, a lot of people increasing visitation at travel information centers and digital inquiries. People contacting us by phone, that's the one area where we have seen a bit of a decrease, but we've seen increases in our customer serve all throughout the board. Our advertising, you're familiar with the More to Explore campaign. That's primarily a program. We focus on the north-central region of the United States, including Canada. We're not able to get a whole lot farther than that, but these are our target markets. Our budget, it's interesting, if you look at the pie chart on the left, is that we put over 60% or 50% of our advertising into digital means, which is a big shift from what we used to do, which is more of the television, the broadcast, direct mail, and things like that. Our breakout is 60% trying to bring in non-residents, because non-residents stay longer and they spend more money. But it's also important to keep Minnesotans traveling in Minnesota, because we don't want to lose those dollars out of our economy. You're familiar with the More to Explore campaign with Joe Maurer. That's mostly in the North Central region. We actually won some awards for this campaign. And this last year, we did we hired a company. We did an RFP and ended up hiring Longwoods International to do an analysis of how good are we doing? Are we really impacting travel? And I showed you a lot of numbers in terms of the customers served and the website traffic, et cetera, but how does that translate in actually people staying and spending more money as a result of seeing the advertising and the efforts that we do? And what this study showed, that we received an 8-to-1 return on investment, generating $154 million in additional spending and 1,850 new jobs. We also do a lot of partnerships, co-op marketing with different agencies. We've done a unique partnership promoting biking with the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Health, Department of Transportation, doing meetings and conventions, a lot of other agency partnerships as well. And I wanted to just briefly mention what we do in the area we call travel trade. It's an area that we don't have the resources to do a lot of consumer advertising, but we work with media and tour operators. We target countries including Germany, Norway, Sweden, Netherlands, the UK, and Japan. We're also looking at expanding potentially in Japan and in France. And a lot of this, what we do is through multi-state partnerships, such as the Great Lakes, USA, and Mississippi River Country specifically. And then the last thing I want to mention before we get into the budget is that it's very interesting that a lot of different agencies are involved in private sector groups in promoting Minnesota. Explore Minnesota, Positively Minnesota, various agencies, whether it's the Historical Society, Lottery, they all talk about Minnesota, but what's our common brand? What's our common theme? How are we talking about Minnesota? And we really don't have one. And so we've engaged in a process to do a lot of consumer research, to talk to stakeholders, to talk to agencies, and we have a lot of buy-in from very high levels in various agencies in the governor's office to develop that brand, which hopefully you'll be seeing more of come this spring and this summer. So when you get to the budget, Mr. Chairman, members, our current budget for fiscal year 13 is an $8.3 million budget that also includes some supplemental funding. We have to generate money from the private sector in order to release those dollars. We rank about 30th in total state budgets. In that incentive that we have to generate money from the private sector, we actually greatly exceed that. We brought in about $5.4 million last year, half of that cash, a little less than half cash, and $3.3 million in kind. So we really try to leverage what we have with other partnerships. Our budget is broken down, as you see now. I won't read all of this again, but big areas, the marketing, communications, and technology are the two largest areas, following by industry relations, travel information centers, and partnership grants, which is a small part of our budget. Also, I'd like to mention the Minnesota Film and TV Board. Their operational funding comes through Explore Minnesota. They were appropriated last session $325,000. They have a match requirement, $1 private for $3 from the state. And there was also actually funding in there for the Upper Minnesota Film Office. Our budget, as I mentioned earlier, we're ranked 30th in the United States, but we're ranked 22 in expenditures. That's leisure and hospitality expenditures, 18 in employment in our industry, and 9th in generated taxes. Now, our budget is not the level as a lot of our competitors. I'm sure a lot of you have seen the advertising from Montana and Colorado and South Dakota and Wisconsin. Every one of those states, Michigan, Missouri, they all have larger budgets than we do. And so we're not able to compete with a lot of those states. And what that means to us specifically is we're not able to get into some markets with high potential, such as Chicago. We're not able to expand into newer markets, such as Kansas City or St. Louis. And we have very limited international reach with the resources that we have. So as a result of that situation of the increasing competition and the lack of ability to accomplish our goals, the governor has recommended an annual budget of $16 million for Explore Minnesota for each of the next two fiscal years. That also includes $500,000 incentive funding. The Minnesota Film and TV Board, their operational funding is still included in the governor's recommended budget, as well as $12,000 for the Upper Minnesota Film Office. The governor did also, in his budget message, include a recommendation to fund this expanded marketing for a car rental tax increase from 6.2% to 9.5%. And this generated revenue is suggested by the governor in order to help fund the needed investment in tourism. He wanted to present a balanced budget, and this is what he recommended as a way to generate those revenues. I would like to emphasize, however, that this is not a dedicated tax. This is something that would appear through the tax committee as a part of the considerations that they are examining. It's mentioned by the governor because he feels that we need to have the revenue in order to cover these necessary investments. So I just wanted to provide some clarification of that. So how the money would be used would be for expanded marketing beyond the region, strengthen our drive markets, expand partnerships, support international and new emerging markets, and allow us to expand our niche markets such as sports marketing, GLBT, ethnic, and meetings and conventions. Going back to that return on investment that I mentioned earlier, if you were to take each additional $1 million that we would receive to go into tourism marketing, that would generate $84 million in traveler spending, 1,000 jobs, $22 million in income, and $8 million in new and state local taxes. So just in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, members, Tourism Minnesota supports communities all throughout the state. It's a very diverse industry, brings revenue and jobs, supports quality of life. It's a promoter of Minnesota as a place to live, work, and to play, and allows us to compete with the competition. So with that, Mr. Chairman, very quickly, I would be happy to answer any questions that you or the members have.
Thank you, Mr. Edmund. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Edmund, how much do you anticipate, or have you already started working with the PGA and any potential European partners for the Ryder Cup that's coming in 2016?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative, we've worked with all the major. We're a very fortunate state, and then we've had all the major competitions. The U.S. Golf Association, the PGA. We've had the Ryder Cup, and we've always been involved with local partners with that and promotion. We are not usually in a position where we can give money to the organizers, but we use it a lot in our international promotion as a way to draw attention to the golf resource. We also have a partnership with the Explore Minnesota Golf Association, and I hope that will not only expand and continue with that particular tournament.
Representative Horton?
Just a quick question, if you can comment on the role of the state park system with regard to tourism.
Mr. Edmund.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Representative, we have a great relationship with the Department of Natural Resources in a number of different programs. One particular that comes to mind is in biking in Minnesota, working with the Department of Natural Resources promoting state bike trails. as well as the two other agencies that we work with. We also work with them on promotion of legacy weekends and trying, actually it's not DNR exclusively, but it's with Minnesota Conservation Association and others, promoting the investment that we make as a state into conservation programs. And we also work with the Department of Natural Resources and a number of other different promotions, whether they be promotions with the Twins, snowmobiling, skiing, fishing opener, etc. We have a very good relationship with the Department of Natural Resources.
Just to follow up, it was kind of, what I was kind of getting at, is it a factor that brings people to the state, the fact that we have the park system? Is it to the information that you have, is it a draw? My understanding is it's the state park system is a pretty big draw for tourism, and I'm just wondering if you have data to back that up.
Mr. Edmund?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we do have a lot of that data. And outdoors is one of the number one things that people think of. When we were doing the branding research, that was one of the things that came out really on top, is one of the things that are most known about the state and why people come and travel to the state. But we're also finding out with the branding initiative that the state is much more diverse than that. It's much more than lakes and woods and waters. It's a state that has the metropolitan areas and the communities and the arts and the culture and the sports and small towns. So we're really trying to capitalize on the authenticity of why people come here, but also expand to expose people to things beyond what they currently know about.
Representative Anders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what kind of feedback you received from the Mall of America and the convention centers? Because I'm guessing the car rental tax will have an impact in their ability to attract people here. Have you gotten any feedback from them on that issue in particular?
Mr. Edmund?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I know our industry has been very supportive of an increase in funding in tourism. One of the things that they were originally talking about was a dedicated car tax, the existing car tax, and not an increase in the car tax. As far as their position regarding the increase, I'm not sure it's been formulated yet, per se. In fact, I was just doing some analysis of other states and other car rental tax, and it's really hard to say where this would put us, because many states are increasing car rental taxes, and there's so many different fees and taxes that are involved, I'm not sure where that would put us in terms of competitive set. But we work quite a bit with the Mall of America and the CVBs in developing positions on this.
Representative Anderson.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Edmund, can you also email me who's going to be paying the car rental tax, breakdown on business travelers, local Minnesotans that maybe have to rent a car because their car is in the shop, versus folks that are coming from outside of the state? If you can get that data for me and just send me an email, that would be really helpful.
Certainly, Mr. Chair and Representative, I can just tell you off the top of my head that we've done a little bit of analysis of that already, and from what I recall, the majority of the car rental tax revenue generated to the state is done at the airport, the vast 60, I think it's a little over 60%, and the majority of those are generally non-residents.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and mine's more of a comment. As we look at the budget, I would just encourage us as we move the budget forward that we look at maybe enhancing a little bit for the film board and TV board. I see it's at $325,000, and I just would strongly argue for the merits of a program such as that, telling our Minnesota story beyond right here. You know, you think of like all the tourism that it's led to, you know, in Iowa with the Madison County movie, or you know, that sort of thing. Or I was watching this movie that I about a religious walk that people do in Spain, and it's called The Way. And you know, tons of people are going to go there and do, you know, encourage tourism. And we've been watching in my home this series from England. It's about Doc Martin, and I'm certain it's going to lead to a trip in my family to go to England and want to experience that. And we've lost good movies in the past that have not only been with Minnesota writers and beyond that, but like Gran Torino wasn't filmed here, written by folks from Minnesota, and could have been done here very easily. We have a community that would have fit perfectly with the film. And so I just, as we look at the budget, I certainly hope that I would encourage Mr. Chair and the members that we enhance that.
Might that community have been North St. Paul, Representative Lilly, or
Close to the east side, perhaps.
On that point, I actually had a question on that very topic, and that is, you had ROI relative to the tourism budget generally. Do you have specific to the film board or film and TV for every dollar spent? Is there a return on that?
Mr. Chairman, members, I know the Minnesota Film and TV Board does have that information. I can't quote that to you. The ROI numbers that I presented to you was specifically just on our advertising, not on film. But to the representative's comment regarding the film board, I used to be on the film board as an official member, but then when the funding came through us, I was ex officio, so I certainly understand the importance of film in order to help promote the state, and that's why I'm involved.
Okay. Members, are there any other questions? I did promise certain members that we'd try to get out of here by 5. It's now 5:01, unless there's any other questions. Mr. Edmund, thank you very much for your brevity and your information. We appreciate it. We'll look forward to seeing you again. And with that, we are adjourned.